passing under the Great Arch for the last time, Queen Elizabeth II.
Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, a senior editor at The New Yorker. Enormous crowds of mourners have gathered across the United Kingdom to pay their respects to Queen Elizabeth II this week. Her 7 decades on the throne saw tremendous political shifts in Britain and great turmoil within her own family. And yet, support for her among Brits barely wavered. In fact, opposition to the monarchy has never risen above 20%. The Queen accomplished something few political figures ever have: consistent, sustained popularity. But what is the future of the monarchy under King Charles III? Is it possible for the House of Windsor to maintain the same kind of public support? John Cassidy, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me today to discuss the future of the royal family and what it will mean for the United Kingdom and its former colonies. Hi, John. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot for inviting me on. Glad to be here.
You wrote an article recently about the royal family's enduring popularity in Britain. So I thought we could maybe start things off on an unjournalistic note. As a Brit who has lived in the United States for decades, how do you personally feel about the monarchy?
Well, I've always had mixed feelings about it. I mean, I grew up in a very working class community in Leeds in Northern England, big industrial city. But I also came from an Irish family where there were sort of very negative feelings about the monarchy. So I've always had respect for the Queen as a sort of royal worker, as the phrase goes these days. You know, she did do 70 years and worked until the very end. But at the same time, I wouldn't describe myself as a strong monarchist. In an ideal world, I wouldn't be a monarchist. If you're asking me whether I'm a Republican, I think they should abolish the British monarchy. I would say it's going to be so difficult politically, given the popularity of the monarchy, that it would rebound badly on any party that tried it. So I'm sort of agnostic on that one.
And can you kind of explain the popularity of the monarchy to me? I feel like it's something that I didn't quite fully understand until the Queen died, and then, you know, just the way in which such a large group of people have been mourning. It's just, yeah, I'm just wondering if you can kind of explain what it is that people are feeling.
I mean, I'd say you have to separate in some way the monarchy from the Queen, which most of the coverage hasn't done this week. I would say in terms of British public support of the monarchy, the polls are sort of 2/3 or so, you know, strong supporters of the monarchy, a third are more sceptical. Certainly the sort of impression I got growing up. There's always been a sizable bunch of sceptics, but a larger group of people who support the monarchy is so tied up with the sort of Britain's view of itself and British history, British imperial history, the Second World War, and how people are educated there, that a lot of English people do think of the monarchy as sort of an essential part of their country on a sort of emotional basis as well as a historical one. Now, if you ask about the Queen, her popularity goes well beyond the popularity of the monarchy. I think that's largely due just to the long service and the fact she's never been involved in any controversy at all. I mean, I give a personal example. My grandmother was a very Irish Republican woman who professed to have no time for the monarchy at all. But every time the Queen came on TV, you know, she'd rush and watch it. The Queen herself has always been very popular, and I think evidently got even more popular as she's got older and sort of carried on in the role. So you're seeing two things in the last week or so. You're seeing an outpouring of personal affection for the Queen herself, underpinned by a smaller but still substantial support for the monarchy as an institution.
I see. And it seems like a lot of Queen Elizabeth's popularity stems from the fact that she was so apolitical. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about how she cultivated this like atmosphere of apolitical civility, and if there were times, you know, major political developments that she actually did kind of get involved in.
I mean, that's she was on the throne for so long. She didn't always stay out of things. I mean, she made a few comments during Brexit, for example, which were interpreted as political. But she generally, from the very moment she took over, sort of abided by the constitutional settlement. It's a constitutional monarchy, and even though there's not a written constitution, the sort of agreement is that the monarch can rule without really ruling. She has to sign off on everything. You know, you see that's why the new prime minister, had to go up to Balmoral to see her before she became prime minister. But that's a purely ceremonial role. It's been a long time since certainly not in this queen's reign, that the queen has tried to exercise any power over appointments like that. You know, she's seen as having kept her side of the bargain, that the deal was the monarchy can continue to exist and most of the British people will support it as long as it sort of stays in its lane. And the queen did that very dutifully and was rewarded for it with popularity.
Charles has agreed to abide by that, but he also seems like a significantly more political figure than Elizabeth was. I mean, I feel like he's been a lot more open about his views when it comes to certain things, including the environment. What do we know exactly about his politics?
Well, he's got a long history of being involved in various causes. Some of the earlier ones were the environment, the inner cities, urban planning. He's interested in organic farming. And, you know, he was one of an early people to talk about the dangers of global warming and climate change as well. So he's always taken a sort of deep interest in a lot of those issues. Now, he's said repeatedly over the last few days that he realises there's a fundamental difference between being the Prince of Wales and being the monarch. And he's actually said he's going to step back from a lot of his charities and a lot of his organisations, and presumably somebody else will take them over and he will be a figurehead. But I think, you know, the British public knows what he supports and what he really feels. And it'll be very interesting to see how he deals with that going forward when he has to attend events at which there are politicians from various parties and representing various causes there, whether he'll actually be able to hold his tongue and sort of do what the Queen did and never tip his hat as to what he really thinks.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems almost impossible. I mean, maybe that's just coming from, you know, an American's point of view, but...
Well, I mean, he's been trained for 70 years to do it, remember? I mean, he's been, you know, he's the longest king in waiting in history. The rap on him always has been that, you know, he wasn't be able to do it, and a lot of people suspected that the Queen kept going for so long because she didn't have the utmost confidence in Charles, especially after the whole Diana story. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see whether he can change and adopt to the role. But he certainly got no excuse in terms of not knowing what's expected and not having seen his mother do it for a very, very long time.
That's for sure. I mean, one thing that I think about is, I mean, doesn't the monarch get a private meeting with the prime minister every week? I mean, what is that meeting, if not political?
It's good. I'm not sure it's every week, but it's certainly regularly. I mean, the Crown made a huge deal of this. You know, if you watch the Crown, they sort of amped up the meetings, especially between Winston Churchill and the Queen.
I think that's how I started thinking about the private meeting thing.
That's the thing. When you're talking about the monarchy, there's perception and reality. I mean, as far as reality goes, I think from what you read from prime ministerial memoirs, etc., the meetings are pretty polite, but also pretty formal. The prime minister just informs the queen what's going on and what the government is planning, etc., and the queen says, oh, okay, thank you very much. I don't think there's been that much back and forth, although maybe there'll be more with Charles.
What is Charles's reputation like in the UK?
I mean, mixed, I would say. He's never been as popular as his mother was, and his reputation took a real dive with Diana. Most British people took Diana's side throughout that, and that was actually the greatest sort of crisis for the royal family in the last 50 years, I'd say, when the Queen and the rest of the royal family stayed up at Balmoral after Diana died. There was nobody in Buckingham Palace and nobody in London while they made initial preparations for the funeral, and there was a great backlash against that with huge crowds appearing outside Kensington Palace. Eventually, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister at the time, actually flew up to Balmoral in Scotland and strongly advised the Queen to return to London and make some public comments. And I think Blair may have saved the monarchy at that point. He certainly saved it from its biggest crisis. But ever since then, Charles's public opinion ratings have not been as strong as the Queen's. He still has majority support, no doubt about that, but I think I quoted one recent poll in my piece that he came out as the seventh most popular royal, behind Princess Anne's daughter, who is his niece, who is a prominent equestrian, but no, not a household name.
Seventh most popular. I love that poll is even being conducted.
Well, yeah, the monarchy is a never-ending source of media stories and, you know, hits online, etc. So there's a gazillion polls and a gazillion stories done about them every year.
One thing that comes up a lot in relation to the monarchy is just how much it costs for the British taxpayers, that it just costs them millions of dollars. And I'm wondering if, you know, you have a sense of whether this cost is going to go down with Charles. I've read various things about how he might shrink the size of the royal family, and I don't even exactly know what that entails. But, I mean, do you see him, like, pursuing different cost-cutting measures?
Yeah, I mean, this has been an issue for the last 25 years, really. There's been sort of various efforts to downsize the monarchy. I mean, there's always two sides to these arguments. Monarchists in the UK would argue that the crown brings in a lot more money in terms of tourism and other revenues to Britain than it costs in terms of the civil list to pay for the royals. And strictly in a sort of cash basis, that may be true. On the other hand, the public, while they support the monarchy, certainly don't support huge outgoings on a lot of relations who don't seem to do very much apart from making the odd public appearance. So outside the immediate royal family, there's always been, not always, but certainly in the last 20 or 30 years since I've been following it, public support for cutting back the size of the monarchy and the sort of scale of it all. And I think Charles, in the last few years, has aligned himself with that. In the last year or so, there's been so many stories quoting royal sources saying, and pretty specific ones, saying that Charles may be planning to cut back to 7 working royals. I guess it would be him and Camilla. It would be William and Kate. It would be Princess Anne and a couple of others. I think the probably Prince Edward and his wife too. So that would just be 7 people who are supported by the civil list, and in return they do, you know, attend official functions and do royal work. I think if he does that, I think that would be a popular move, because as I say, even though there's strong support for the monarchy in principle, there's also a strong scepticism that, you know, some of the royals might be freeloading and not actually giving value for money.
So support among the Brits seems pretty stable, but what about abroad, like the former colonies that are technically their own, you know, self-governing nations, but still recognize the British monarch as their titular head, at least?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I mean, the British Commonwealth consists of 2 types of countries. It's 56 countries. Most of them are self-governing and have their own head of state. I think about 30-odd of them are republics, and then 4 or 5 have their own monarchs. But there are still, I think it's 14 countries where the British monarch is still the titular head of state. The big ones are Australia and New Zealand and Canada, the biggest ones, but there are also a lot of Caribbean islands and a couple of places in the Pacific. And what we've seen over the last 20 years is a sort of gradual movement to question that status. Most recently in Barbados, last year they voted to become a republic. There have been demands for similar moves in Jamaica and other places. It's also become an issue in Australia, where there's now a Republican prime minister who has said that in his second term he'll support moves towards a republic rather than the first term. Canada, it's not such a big issue. I think just as time goes on and as decades go on, it's, you know, increasingly difficult to justify to the citizens of these countries having a British monarch. You know, the British Empire is, you know, receding into history. Whether this will be a huge issue during Charles' reign or his successor's reign, but it's something that rumbles on and is not going to go away.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So I feel like it's hard to talk about the royals without at least mentioning Meghan and Harry. So I'm wondering, do you see any signs that what they've said about how they were treated and the allegations of racism that, I mean, have you gotten the sense that that's had a real impact on how the monarchy is perceived or its popularity?
I mean, in general, the sort of great tabloid saga of Meghan and Harry hasn't had that much impact on the monarchy, I don't think. You're seeing some sort of efforts this week by the palace to suggest that maybe there's going to be a healing in the breach. There have been a couple of walkabouts, as they call it in the UK, where the two brothers and their wives have sort of, you know, mingled with the public for a few minutes. And that's been portrayed in the Fleet Street press as a sort of harbinger for a great reconciliation. I don't know if that's true. As for Meghan, she gets very rough treatment still by parts of the Fleet Street press. And that's continued even since the Queen's death. So I think that there's no sign of that relationship being healed. I mean, and Prince Charles, one of the things he said in his first speech very conspicuously was he wished them best in their life in the USA or their life overseas or whatever he said. So that seemed to be an indication, you know, that they weren't thinking about moving back to the UK or whatever.
Yeah. I feel like it was after their interview with Oprah, I think that was last year, that people, at least in the US, started talking a bit more about whether the monarchy was going to last or whether it might be on its way out. But then it's interesting because we talk and it seems like, you know, popularity for the monarchy, at least for the Queen, has been pretty stable. And, you know, under Charles, it will likely be the same way. I mean, you know, getting rid of the monarchy, is that something that's really talked about that often in the UK? Or is that just like, you know, Americans forcing this conversation to happen through a lens that they understand?
As I said, there's always been an active Republican movement in the UK, but it's very much a minority one, which is why I said at the very beginning of our conversation that even though I might support it in principle, I think, you know, it's a very tricky cause for any political party to take up. The Republicans tend to be in the Labour Party, the sort of left-leaning party in the UK. But the first thing the Labour's leader, Keir Starmer, said, you know, he's been very much aligning himself with the monarchy and the new king this week. He just sees it as, you know, a political hot potato he just doesn't want to touch, I don't think. And that's been the case for a long time. So back to Harry and Meghan, you know, there was some talk in media circles about what the impact that would have on, you know, her criticism of the monarchy, and that she didn't accuse the Queen or any individual member of the Royal Family of being racist, but she did suggest that some of the royal court, royal officials were. And mm-hmm. there was a lot of pushback against that, and the Conservative papers on Fleet Street took the side of, you know, the royal family. And that, I think there is still some fallout from that. But I wouldn't say it's something, you know, which is a topic of constant conversation in the pubs and restaurants around England.
So both British and American media have been totally consumed by the Queen's death. What do you think is up with the American media being so incredibly interested, not just in the Queen, but in the royal family?
Yeah, I mean, it's been pretty astonishing to me, I must say. I mean, I've lived here for getting on for 35 years now. But the sort of enduring sort of fascination with the monarchy is still something which I honestly can't claim to fully understand. I think part of it is just a straight media-driven thing, that they're, you know, especially in this age of 24-hour media and endless digital demand for product, the royal story is a sort of an attractive product. It's been an ongoing soap opera for like 30 years, ever since Diana got involved with them anyway. And it's got good visuals, which is why you see all the networks sending all their anchors over to England for the week, because fundamentally it's a visual medium. And one thing the royals do, and very well, is put on a visual pageant. So I think that sort of explains the media interest. Now, the question is, why are individual Americans interested? Some people would say they're not, and the media is just massively overdoing it. I agree with that to some extent, but just in my own personal experience talking to people of last week and things, people who I wouldn't think would have any interest at all in the story do seem to have expressed some interest. I've seen people talking in stores about it, about the Queen and Prince Charles, which, you know, I don't think I ever see them talking about the British Prime Minister or the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, etc. You know, it's something different, right? And it's a soap opera. It's an ongoing soap opera. You're American. You tell me what is the fascination? It's an enduring question, I think, especially, you know, for a country which was built on getting rid of the royals to begin with, that now 250 years later or whatever it is, you turn on your TV every night and there's the royal funeral.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard question. I've never fully understood it. I mean, one thing that I noticed, I was talking to my dad about this, he's just like the last person you would think of as someone who would care at all about the royals. And he immediately was like, oh, well, I hate Charles because of Diana. And just like, it was so weird because even the idea that my dad would like know who Diana is. I mean, I feel like she in particular is someone who really penetrated American culture.
I do also think the Queen herself is just, you know, because she went on for so long and was the not just the longest ruling British monarch, but, you know, probably one of the longest ruling monarchs anywhere in the world over the last however many centuries, is just that in itself, you know, is a spectacle. So it's a big event when she dies. But apart from that, as I said, I think a lot of it is just that it's a story which goes on and on. You know, it doesn't stop like, you know, individual series. It's just, it's been going on. It's been ongoing for decades and people have grown up with it. And they know, as you say, like your father, they sort of, you know, it's 25 years since Diana died. It was just more than 25 years. And no, that's pretty astonishing that people have still got it fresh in their minds.
So in your piece, you ask the question of whether Charles will rise to the occasion. And I'm wondering what that means in this context. Like, you know, in this case, would rising to the occasion mean just being totally apolitical in the way that his mother was in order to unite a divided country? Or would it mean standing up for climate action, even if that's the kind of thing that wouldn't typically be expected of the British monarch?
Obviously, your judgment of what a success is depends on where you come at this from. I mean, there's no neutral answer to that. You know, if you think the monarch should get involved in causes like in environmental change, then obviously you want to see Charles taking a more active role. Monarchists, as I say, I'm not speaking as one of them because I don't count myself as a monarchist, but they would say that success for Charles is following in the tradition of his mother and keeping the pageantry, keeping the constitutional settlement in which the Queen is the head of state. And the only way you can really do that, they would say, is by, you know, occupying a sort of strange role whereby you are consulted on everything, but you don't actually make very many decisions, if any. So that will be the advice he's getting, not just from monarchists around the country, but from the royal staff, etc. And I think that you see that reflected in, you know, all the statements he's made since his mother's death. And I think that's what we'll see over the next week after the funeral and in his initial tours. I would imagine he'll do sort of goodwill tours around the country and maybe around the world. And I'm sure that's the impression he'll be seeking to give. Now, is that a success? You know, that, as I say, that all depends on what view you take overall of the British monarchy.
One thing that I was wondering about, I'm not sure what kind of thoughts you'll have on this, but just like sort of the role of gender in the monarchy, because I feel like, I mean, I just think it's interesting now that we have Charles and then would it be the next three people who come after him are all men? And whether you think that the popularity of the monarchy might shift at all with, you know, just the fact that we're entering this era of male monarchs.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I wouldn't say I have any sort of deep insight into that. The fact that the Queen was extremely popular and she was a woman is obviously, you know, very interesting. And Charles, you know, is obviously a very different character, not just a different gender. I mean, I think one of the reasons the Queen was so popular is that she stood out in a way. Not so much now because there are a lot of female leaders around the world. But when she started out, I mean, the patriarchy was even more powerful then than it is now, and she really stood out as a woman. She probably gave some inspiration to some women around the world in the Commonwealth and elsewhere. That's all going to change, obviously, under Charles. In fact, it looks like there's going to be kings as far as the eye can see. I think we'll just have to wait and see how that works out. It'll certainly be a different sort of sense of the monarchy, given that it's a king rather than a queen, no doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely part of the reason, I think, why she was so iconic as a leadership figure. And so it'll be interesting to see whether... yeah, people are even maybe just more uncomfortable with the idea of being ruled by a male monarch, which seems, you know, I guess more dated in a way.
Yeah, ruled, you see. I mean, the whole trick of the monarchy is that they don't appear to rule. So, you know, that's... they have the privileges of monarchy without the powers.
And immunity from laws and that sort of thing.
And, you know, just enormous wealth as well. I mean, we haven't spoken about the enormous wealth of the monarchy. And as you say, the financial benefits it brings to them. All those issues are, you know, out there. As I say, the colonial issues, post-colonial issues. And as long as the Queen was there, she somehow kept a lid on all that. You know, all those questions were sort of put into abeyance while she was still Queen. The Queen sort of froze the monarchy in the sort of second half of the 20th century successfully. But, you know, this is another century, so
Let's see if her successors are up to it.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. All right, well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me on.
John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker, who writes a weekly column about economics and politics. You can read his article, Where Does the British Monarchy Go Under King Charles III, on newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show was produced by Michelle Moses. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening.